Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Everyday Anarchism. I'm your host, Graham Culbertson, and welcome back to Everyday Anarchism, Luke Kemp. Luke, thanks for joining me again.
Graham, thank you for having me again.
So this conversation is different. We're not talking about David Graeber's work. We're not talking about James C. Scott's work. We're talking about a book by Luke Kemp. So why don't you tell us about it?
Recently, I had published a book called Goliath's Curse, The History and Future of Societal Collapse. It's a project I've been working on since 2018, so approximately 7 years now. And while it's focused upon collapse, I found that once you pull on the thread of collapse, you essentially untangle the entire tapestry of history. It's difficult to talk about collapse without talking about what is collapsing, what is civilization, if you will. And it's difficult to talk about collapse without talking about why do we create states and civilizations in the first place. And it's difficult to talk about that without going into what do we look like during the Paleolithic and how do we change once the environment warmed and we entered the Holocene. So essentially, you have to, in many ways, kind of rediscover history. And so for me, this was, in a way, trying to clarify my own mind about what happened across the grand sweep of history in order to better understand how I can think about catastrophe in the future. And I have to say, doing the project for the last 7 years dramatically transformed my worldview.
Okay. Yeah, that's there's already a lot there to respond to. So let's just say something. You and I have actually been corresponding about this and talking in person about this for a while now, where there's no way we're going to get everything, not just everything in the book, but everything in terms of just what you and I have already been discussing into this interview. So we've agreed, dear listeners, Luke and I, we're going to get to what we can, and then I was sure Luke was coming back on the podcast someday anyway, so probably there will be future episodes on this book, Goliath's Curse, but we'll do what we can now. And I mean, instead of, you know, the question I'm next supposed to ask, which is please further describe the book and the three parts, I'm going to ask instead, tell us about the transformation that you have undergone. Did writing this book make you an anarchist? Is that what you're trying to say?
In short, yes.
That's it. We're done. That was so easy.
Going into the book, I had a fair bit of skepticism around democracy. I, for context, was lecturing climate change, science and policy back in Australia at the Australian National University. And I certainly had an inclination towards this idea of the enlightened dictator, that we just needed someone in charge who had the authority and force to get shit done. And of course, I had the misbegotten idea in the back of my head that that person would be like me, essentially. They'd want to have all the good things that I like being instituted. And of course, in reality, that's not the case. And additionally, I had a bit more of a pessimistic view about humans. I wouldn't say I was a full Hobbesian. I didn't believe we existed in a state of war against all or anything like that. But in general, I thought humans probably didn't handle collapse and stress very well, that we're probably more prone to tribalism and violence than to peace and cooperation. So overall, I was fairly pessimistic about humans. I guess I embraced the idea of mass panic and chaos, and I was certainly more leaning towards the idea that we need dictators rather than democracy to overcome our grandest challenges. And I don't believe any of those things whatsoever anymore. And don't like to brand myself too much, but it essentially has been a move towards embracing democracy and the basic ideals of anarchism.
Okay. Yeah, good. Then let me push further. And this is the part, this is the thing that I was withholding from you in our conversation in Cambridge, is that this is an explicitly anarchist book. You even have in your conclusion, you trot out the old phrase, no gods, no masters, although I think you add kings or heroes in there. Anyone who knows anything about anarchism can read anarchism in every page of this book. This reminds me of the Graeber Wingrove book, Dawn of Everything, that I was taught, you know, I've spoken to a number of people about it. And one of my colleagues, Aris Politopoulos, who came on this show to discuss the book, said that one of his colleagues read it and said, you must love this book. It's anarchism on every page. Mm. And yet, in the dawn of everything, the word anarchist or anarchism shows up once or twice.
Yeah.
It's the same for Goliath's Curse, Luke. You have written a book in which I would say almost every page is an expression of anarchist values. And yet I'm not talking to Luke Kemp, anarchist intellectual. I'm talking to Luke Kemp, very serious scholar of history. So come on, man, join the A-team.
I do like the idea of eventually, if you will, coming out. However, at this stage, one has to accept. I have to accept.
Yeah, it's nicer when you're out. It is, but it's true that people will start looking at you differently.
And this is the thing I find in my personal conversations with people. When you ask them, do you like the idea of democracy? Do you think that we should all be fairly equal in terms of power? Do you think that we should try to basically base our cooperation upon voluntary collaboration and mutual aid rather than violence where possible? People almost always say yes to all those things. And yet, if you say, are you an anarchist, they won't look at you the same way again. And that's because there's been an incredibly successful propaganda campaign. The same kind of campaign that has put civilization on a pedestal has also denigrated the idea of anarchism to the extent where it's essentially now just is seen as throwing a brick through a window, which of course we all know that's not what anarchism is about whatsoever, but that's how it's been warped in the public perception. And I know that if I open the book by saying this research and empirical exploration has pushed me towards anarchist ideals, and one can perceive this as an anarchist retake of history, every reader, most readers apart from the anarchists among us, would automatically put it down or not take it seriously. And for me, it's often been less important what one defines themselves in terms of theorists, and much more in terms of, as you mentioned, the values. And while most of my values are fairly anarchist, and most of my kind of theoretical lens here is an anarchist one of, as Scott would say, an anarchist squint of just questioning, are these hierarchies legitimate? Where do they come from? And people agree with that basic tenet, but at the same time, I also, you know, have bits of historical materialism in there as well. Some of my values, you know, more like virtue ethics, etc., which, you know, overlap of anarchism and aren't quite there. But once again, as soon as you pigeonhole yourself into one theoretical lens, people are automatically going to paint a picture about both you, your motivations, and your work, which wouldn't be helpful in this case. And at the end of the day, I'm fairly practical insofar as I know people are going to respond well to democracy. And ultimately, to me, anarchism always was just essentially democracy, just taking democracy seriously.
Yeah, and we've spoken about this already in terms of the connection between anarchism and democracy. I agree with you in terms of that. I mean, look, this is something I think about a lot. I mean, just first of all, in terms of my podcast, I've said this to plenty of people. I've probably said it on the air, but I can't remember. If this podcast were called Embracing True Democracy or something like that, it would not have very many listeners, you know? So in that sense, for me, using the word anarchism was a precisely the same way that you say not calling yourself an anarchist was a way to get people to listen. Calling myself an anarchist was a way to get people to listen, especially with the everyday branding and the coffee cup, because I'm subverting the brick through the window thing. Mm. But I am troubled still by the number of people who don't take me seriously because I'm an anarchist, and troubled by precisely, as you say, everyone likes the ideas of, and I mean, there's the old joke that Americans will always vote for socialism given the chance to vote for socialism unless it's got the word socialism in it, and then they will vote against it. Another way of putting it, right, for our purposes is everyone is an anarchist, at least literally everyone, I think, is an anarchist for themselves. Some people believe other people need to be restrained by coercive power, but people don't want to claim the word. And my take is that, so I'm going to blame, you know, two people who are no longer with us. And then a third in our conversation about, I think, James C. Scott, you mentioned that, you know, the three most famous anarchist intellectuals were Chomsky, Graeber, and Scott, two of whom are no longer with us. Mm. But of those three, Graeber was the only one whose obituary was going to put the word anarchist in like the first line. And even Graeber, you know, I think "Don't call me the anarchist anthropologist" was like one of his like Twitter handle for a while. So I'm not sure that, in other words, you're right. If you call yourself an anarchist, people aren't going to take you seriously. But people take anarchists seriously as long as we don't use that word. So if we could just, it's a collective action problem. So I'm blaming you. I mean, Chomsky used the word, Graeber used the word, obviously Scott used the word. Chomsky, Scott, and Graeber all have books with anarchist in the title, but they also, when they wanted to make sure they were taken seriously and in their most famous works, debt is not called debt, an anarchist history of finance. That's not what it's called. And I'm just ready for a few more of you, like more mainstream, taken seriously people. I'm a basement podcaster, so like I can call myself an anarchist. But will a few more of you have the bravery, maybe in your next book? How about that? I'm kidding about.
I love the fact that you call me mainstream as well. I like that. And taken seriously as well. I said, I just love the fact that I'm mainstream and taken seriously. Jokes aside, I am considering and probably veering towards, when I publish a future book, which is going to be focused upon essentially when do democratic hierarchies work and when should one rely more upon, let me rephrase that, when do more decentralized structures work and when should we rely upon hierarchy? And essentially, how do you allow for larger scale democratic hierarchies to operate? And if I wrote that book, I think I'd want to probably either begin or end with like a pretty explicit, I'm an anarchist, this is an anarchist take. For now, I think that would be shooting myself in the foot before I've made a name for myself. And as mentioned, I'm pretty certain that if they open the book with a kind of theoretical declaration of sorts, it would have automatically changed the way in which everyone reads the book thereafter and how seriously they take the ideas. And frankly, I think it also is just difficult because anarchism, people, first of all, don't understand it. And secondly, it has lots of different interpretations. And I think I'm probably closer to a kind of Scottian anarchist of often using anarchism as a kind of theoretical tool, the anarchist squint, if you will. And in terms of values, I mean, it's difficult because I think that, as you mentioned, the basic anarchist values is everyone essentially holds. And beyond that, how anarchism looks in practice does, of course, vary across different anarchist takes and traditions. So in short, I do hope to kind of wave the flag one day, but this was a pretty practical take of, if you do it too early, people will burn the flag. And if you do it later on, they might rally around it. We'll see. But I have been impressed and surprised by how many people just agree with most of the basic ideas here. And one of the most common things I've gotten from in response to the book has been the idea of moral clarity. And that's what I think anarchism offers in most ways, is just a sheer moral clarity.
Okay, I'm gonna let you off the hook at this point now. In terms of anarchism,
right?
you're not off the hook permanently. I mean, what it is, I'm like one of those hard ass BBC interviewers, and I've gotten what I wanted now, which is you've agreed to call yourself an anarchist in your next book, and now we can move on and talk about something else.
For the record, I said I'm considering it and veering towards it. And this would be the third or the fourth book, not the next book. But I appreciate the BBC hard talk angle.
I hate that shit. I mean, I like it when they're using it against, like, you know, someone who is a spokesperson for Putin, but they use it against everyone. And there's some, you know, school teacher who's trying to explain why they are teaching books about trans literature in the classroom. And the BBC person is like, but are you saying these are always appropriate? And this poor teacher is just spluttering and sad, but because they've been gotten by the BBC. Sorry.
It becomes a gimmick. And I always love the idea of you punch up, you don't punch down. And that's the way I do interviews as well.
All right. So tell us about this grand sweep of the book. I know it's got three sections. We've got time. We've We've saved all of our anxieties about time by just saying we can do another one of these. So take as much time as you need. Do we want to go? I guess let's go section by section. So tell us about section one of the book.
I think it's always good to start at the beginning, particularly in this case, where I believe to understand the sweep of history, you really have to start with people's presumptions about human nature and what I would call evolutionary inclinations. Essentially, what are things we tend to do in the absence of a strong cultural push otherwise? And those are all things that were molded into us 300,000 years ago. That's approximately found the first remains of Homo sapiens is 300,000 years ago. And this period covers what's usually called the Paleolithic, which for shorthand often called the Ice Age, you can call it the Stone Age as well. Although this was actually a period of multiple ice ages. So multiple ice ages, multiple periods of warm. And it was also a pretty dangerous, difficult time. There was 86 active volcanoes across Africa and big climatic swings constantly occurring. Agriculture was nigh impossible, and we were just one amongst many hominid species, many humans, if you will, which roamed across Africa out into the world, and yet we were the only ones that survived. And a key discovery I found is that the best way to understand how we survived actually leads one towards an understanding that we were uniquely egalitarian, interconnected, and cooperative. And when you actually take a step back and think of the, if you will, Pinker-esque narrative of human nature, that we're pretty, if you will, Hobbesian, that by ourselves life is solitary, nasty, brutish, and short. We're not particularly good at cooperation. We tend to be in these very small groups either of individuals or of small families who are parochial, prone to tribalism, and prone to violence. And in Pinker's case, he thinks we had a rate of roughly 15% lethal violence. In other words, for every 100 individuals, 15 of those die due at the hands of another human. That doesn't make much sense when you think about us surviving through the Paleolithic. If we were constantly killing each other, and that was essentially making things like trade and cooperation prohibitive, and if every time we had a big natural disaster, we fell into disorder and a Hobbesian scramble for resources, how the fuck do we make it out of the Ice Age? That's a terrible evolutionary strategy. And when you put it in the actual, and it's funny because, you know, Pinker and others always like to frame this in terms of evolution, but when you really think about whether or not we'd survive, this is just a terrible survival strategy. And quite to the contrary, when you think about how humans survived and why we survived while other hominids didn't, it comes down once again largely to cooperation and interconnections. So when we think about hunter-gatherers, we often think small groups of families, usually 20 to 40. In reality, group size often varies up to 150 or 200. And while there may be small groups, they're constantly intermixing and they're very fluid across groups. And an individual will often know thousands of people across their lifetime. So they have small groups, but very big societies. On top of that, within these groups, they often have less than 10% of people being closely genetic related. And you even have people who speak different tongues. This makes sense insofar as you need to have a lot of genetic mixing in order to have genetic diversity in order to survive. If you have a lot of genetic homogeneity, you tend to get inbreeding, you tend to get allele effects, as they're called, and it just basically makes the entire population much more fragile. On top of that, if you want to spread culture and you want to have lots of changes in terms of the development of things like tools, etc., you need to have those being shared across groups. And generally speaking, when groups share new technology, they share new culture, you get new things appearing. What in economics is often called recombinative growth. And that seems to happen across the archaeological record as well. New groups meet, you tend to get new neolithic technologies. And similarly, in the archaeological record, we can see that roughly 120,000 years ago, all the way from the west coast of Africa through to the east coast, you have evidence of shared instruments, shared culture, shared technology, and shared genes. What I call fluid civilizations. People were highly mobile, they were constantly mixing across groups, they were very cooperative, and all of that was enabled by the fact that they weren't particularly violent. So people like Pinker like to put this kind of hawkish, belligerent narrative upon human nature, but when you actually take a good look at the evidence, it falls apart rather quickly. So Pinker and others like to often point towards anthropological evidence. This is looking at modern-day hunter-gatherers, and many of these aren't nomadic egalitarians. Most of them have a long history of either being at war with or interacting with states. And this skews the evidence quite a lot. So first of all, you have a huge range all the way from the Bakari people in Brazil who have a rate of roughly 0% lethal violence through to the Aceh of Paraguay, who roughly 55 out of 100 people die due to lethal violence. The catch is that in the case of the Aceh, the vast majority of those deaths are from ranchers, colonizers, farmers, and others killing them, and a lot of the others are from things like alcohol. Not exactly a deep insight into human nature or the Paleolithic. Instead, what we can do is look at archaeology, which Pinker tries to do and does so incredibly poorly. In his list of 21 sites, three are duplicates, and only one actually dates back to the Stone Age, Jebel Sahara. A much better analysis here was done by two archaeologists, Haas and Spistelli, and they looked at 3,000 skeletons across 400 sites, and they basically found only six of those sites have any signs of violence whatsoever. Four of those are individuals with some sign of violence, like a cranial trauma, a parry wound, essentially from blocking a blow, for instance, or embedded projectiles. But it's difficult to tell, are those actual examples of murders and killings, or are those accidents, for instance? We don't know. There's one triple burial, and none of those bodies actually have signs of violence. It could just be they were doing this for a ceremonial purpose. The only example across the entire Paleolithic, across 300,000 years and thousands of skeletons, is one site called Jebel Sahaba in Sudan. And it is incredibly unique. It's got 58 skeletons of signs of violence, yes, but it also happened roughly 10,000, 12,000 years ago during the transition into the Holocene. And that area in particular was going through a huge environmental upheaval. Not exactly, again, a good analog for what's happening across most of the Paleolithic. When you look at genetic evidence, best evidence right now suggests that probably a maximum of 2% of deaths occur due to lethal violence. And apart from that, when you look at the actual willingness of us to kill each other, it seems pretty low. There's loads of studies from battlefield reenactments, analyses of looking at how many muskets and rifles were fired during war, and interviews with soldiers, which collectively suggest that often up to half of people don't fire their weapons, or if they do, they fire it away from the enemy. And it kind of makes sense insofar as, would we really have PTSD being so prevalent if we descended from a whole bunch of successful murderers? Probably not. And it's always worth pointing out that people like to point to chimpanzees and be like, look, chimps are really violent and we're related to them, ergo, we must be very violent. First of all, we have many primates who aren't so violent, like bonobos. And secondly, there's been a great book by, I believe it was Brian Ferguson, which explores all these different examples of chimp warfare, and every single case it seems to be caused by human interference. And apart from that, chimps are also different to us. They actually have a whole bunch of genetic changes that make them better at dealing with stress during conflict scenarios. They essentially clot blood quicker as well, which makes it easy to deal with fighting. And all of these genetic changes, which suggest a high proclivity towards violence, all happen before they, after they diverge from humans, which means that we seem to be actually substantially less violent than our chimp relatives. Collectively, all the evidence points towards we're not actually that violent. We tend to like to be peaceful. We tend to like to cooperate quite a lot. And we're definitely not solitary. We're an incredibly social primate. And these are the ingredients that allow us to survive. We don't know why most of our hominids died out, but the leading theory right now is that they weren't as genetically diverse as we were. Their populations weren't as interconnected. While we had these big fluid civilizations across Africa or even across Eurasia, what's called the Aurignacian 48,000 years ago, when you look at burial remains of Neanderthals, they tend to have a similar level of genetic diversity as endangered mountain gorillas. So we like to think we survived because we were smarter. That doesn't seem to be the case. Neanderthals were very smart. They had burial practices. They had the ability to have symbolic imagination, even language. It seems much more likely it's because we could cooperate larger at scale, and more importantly, we intermingled and mixed across groups much more frequently.
A couple things to say in response to that. The first is that This argument is made by Peter Kropotkin in his masterpiece and the still the greatest work of anarchist theory ever written, Mutual Aid. And he doesn't have all of the evidence that you just marshaled. What he has is an understanding of evolution that is, in my opinion, unrivaled. I'd put him above Darwin and certainly over someone like Huxley, given that he...
Darwin's bulldog?
Yeah. And I mean, look, there's a lot... I was just talking to someone about this, an expert on evolution who had, of course, not read any Kropotkin, because why would you read Kropotkin? Because he's wrong about things. Huxley is very smart, and Huxley absolutely destroys Herbert Spencer's evolutionary theory, which is good because Herbert Spencer's evolutionary theory is deliriously wrong. And then in one of just like the great moments in history, the great Russian anarchist Kropotkin and then the great American theory of democracy, John Dewey, write responses to Huxley that are more or less identical. Kropotkin's is very famous. Dewey's is locked away in some journal, and I'm literally the only one I have ever spoken to who has read it. But they make the same claim that, which is, I guess now I'm off on this. Damn it. I didn't mean to do this. So Huxley says essentially, evolution, you know, is good because it creates things like competition. And it creates, you know, things that you want. But when humans get involved, they can make things like, you know, tomatoes that are much bigger and also need and more delicious, but also need lots more care. And so they will be outcompeted by their wild counterparts. And so humans have to intervene and halt the flow of the evolutionary process to keep the tomatoes growing in their garden. And both Kropotkin and Dewey say, well, but humans are in fact the products of evolution. So Huxley's claim that evolution does not account for our big, beautiful tomatoes that we love, not the shitty ones that the agro growers grow, is a mistake because it assumes that the human impulse to guide evolution to big, beautiful tomatoes was not the product of evolution, but it is the product of evolution. So Huxley wants to have this evolution is red in tooth and claw, and then humans are lovely and beautiful and cooperative for some extra evolutionary reason, but humans are lovely and beautiful and cooperative, not for an extra evolutionary reason, precisely for evolutionary reasons. And precisely. If that insight from Kropotkin and Dewey had been picked up by evolutionary thinkers when it was first put down 130 years ago, I don't know if we would have Steven Pinkers running around explaining this shit to us. I don't know. I'm sorry, but it upsets me so much. No one's even read this Dewey article. I don't know. I'm sorry.
Once you see it, it's difficult to unsee. And now I frankly find it kind of silly that people hold this alternative view. And I try to be charitable where possible, but when I think about it, I'm just like, really, we're this violent and this solitary, focused, and uncooperative. We're so trying.
No, Luke, we aren't. Survive? We're good people.
Individuals, yes, of course.
Yes. Sorry, keep. No, I don't mean. I mean, we like 21st century humans are nice and cooperative and have built good institutions like NATO and the World Bank. It's just them out there in their huts with their bows and arrows murdering each other. Thank goodness we've moved beyond that. I'm sorry I interrupted.
I think this is the interesting part of their version of history, is that essentially humans are bad, but hierarchical institutions are good. And that
because they make humans be good.
Yeah, precisely. You know, you have what they would refer to as pacification, so we suddenly become much less violent, etc. But it really boils down to exactly that. And that's also why I think when they look towards the future, they tend to be like, it's pretty good because we'll have more technology, more hierarchical institutions, and hence more ways to tame our otherwise violent bad nature. But again, I just don't think humans are actually that bad. That being said, and this is where it becomes more complicated, humanity is not one homogenous whole. We do have variation amongst our members, and there's good reasons to believe that there are parts of the human species and certain traits which, you know, aren't particularly good. And one of the ones I flag in the book is this idea of status competition, which status competition and the desire for status appears to be more or less universal across people. Understandable, when you have higher status, it does seem to result in a reproductive benefit. You're both more likely to have more children and more likely to survive through to adulthood. But the big catch here is that, well, it's twofold. First of all, there's differences between how you get status. So one way is through prestige, basically impressing others for the benefits you can give to the group. And the second is through domination, essentially taking it by force and having status through the threat of violence. And the second one is that not everyone has the equal desire for status. You know, many of us are actually pretty content with just close loved ones and family members, for instance, thinking well of us. But some people have a much greater craving for status. And some of this is just simply genetic variation. Some people just seem to want status more. Men in particular seem to have a higher craving for status. And people who are higher in what's called the dark triad, which is a collection of three antisocial personality traits. So Machiavellianism, a willingness to manipulate others for personal gain. Psychopathy, a certain callousness and lack of empathy. And narcissism, an overinflated sense of self and ego. All three of those tend to be correlated with greater desire for status domination. And when we look at why hunter-gatherers are egalitarian, there's multiple reasons. One is just sheerly material. They don't have much surplus, and hence it's hard for someone to actually create a hierarchy over and hold it over time. The second is that it's really hard to raise human babies if you just try to have one alpha male doing it. And interestingly, we probably don't have as much what's called cult revolution, basically developing new technologies and ideas and passing them on for the future if you have this kind of like harem set up like gorillas have. In short, kids would only be learning from one high status male and not from everyone, and hence they'd develop less skills overall and be less likely to transmit those into the future. And we also have a whole bunch of other markers, like our ability to maintain eye contact is actually equated to higher levels of egalitarianism. Well, species like apes, if you look in the eyes, they are not happy. They see it as a status challenge, basically. And apart from that, we also just have a good reason to believe that egalitarianism was a choice that was enforced violently quite frequently. So roughly 2 million years ago, actually, I believe, we have these anatomical changes to our shoulder joint, which allows us to throw things much more accurately, like spears. Roughly the same time, you also see what's called sexual dimorphism, which is essentially the differences in stature between men and women. That begins to decrease. So on average, men and women today only have around about a 15% difference in stature. The evolutionary story here is that there's not really a benefit to being big, brawny, and having sharp teeth if someone can simply ambush you in the night with spears, or a small coalition of other males can do so. Hence why in the case of silverbacks, it tends to select, gorillas select basically silverbacks who are very big, have very sharp teeth. That's the evolutionary advantage. We don't really have that. And when you look at anthropological studies, that seems to hold up. There's a good body of work by an anthropologist called Christopher Bohm, where he looks at nomadic egalitarian groups, and he finds that quite frequently there are individuals who try to dominate the rest of the group. And what tends to happen is they have practices that stop that from occurring, what are called counter-dominant strategies. These range from ridicule through to ostracism, getting kicked out of the group, through to, in the very worst cases, in-group executions. One of those famous is, I believe, a case study of the Khoisan, where they have one hunter called Toa, who's killed, I believe, 3 people in the group. And eventually they go and talk to his family and they decide an execution is necessary. They ambush him, fire poison arrows into him, and then everyone comes up and collectively shares the kill by piercing him with a spear. And this seems to be pretty common across nomadic egalitarian groups. So this is not a purely benevolent story of humans. There are people who try to dominate. Most of us do desire status. But throughout human history, desiring status was more likely to get you an early grave than a page in the history books. And that looks dramatically different in comparison to when we look back throughout history of the last 5,000 years. And you have figures like Napoleon, Genghis Khan, even Hitler, for instance, who essentially are renowned and remembered across the ages because of dominance.
Yeah, and I would even add that I mean, there's lots of ways that it seems like desiring status can go wrong, but you can, of course, write the rules of your community that you can gain status via egalitarianism. And that might set up a weird, I'm more humble than you feedback loop. This is Nietzsche's joke about the Pope, basically, is like, oh, that guy's so humble, we put him on a throne and put him in a palace. That seems like that went wrong. But there are, it seems to me, communities that do a good job of making the way to earn status is not via dominance, but in fact, via mutual aid. And exactly. I also just want to say I appreciate Kropotkin himself again says that mutual aid is not the factor of evolution. It is a factor of evolution. And I think there's certainly a mistaken view about Kropotkin, but also about anarchists in general, that we think that humans are always good. I think Graeber has a line I've quoted a lot that says something like humans will behave more or less as decently as they are allowed to in a given social situation. And the more or less allows for all sorts of all sorts of variations. And I think that more or less is accurate.
Yeah. Again, with the caveat of there are variations across humans. You know, some of us are better than others. Some of us are more virtuous. And there's definitely some of us who are less virtuous. And I think that doesn't account for all of human history, but I think it's often a factor which is overlooked.
Yeah, and I don't want to go down this road too far, but I certainly know people who argue. I mean, for example, Richard Rorty famously argued this using more Freud than was probably good for Richard Rorty or anyone, that essentially, you know, when you get this dark triad, it comes from a lack of care and love as a young person. I seriously doubt that is universal, that if everyone had a good childhood, we would have no one with the dark triad. But I would also think there's no doubt that if more people had good childhoods, we would have far fewer people with these bad characteristics. And then the idea that children need to be punished and disciplined so that they will grow up to be good people becomes hilariously, I mean, tragically, but hilariously counterintuitive. You know, the beatings will continue until the violence stops.
Yeah, I think that from my understanding of the dark triad, it's a combination, as of most things, of nurture and nature. There's definitely people who are genetically predisposed to us. And from twin studies, it appears that's the case as well. But it does seem to be essentially amplified and potentially made much, much worse and even created for environmental circumstances. That being said, I also don't want to hook too much onto the dark triad in particular, which I think can often fall into a parody of this is just down to a couple of villains and bad people. In the book, I talk about these more general darker angels of our nature. The dark triad is one. Another one is, as mentioned, status competition through domination, which is broader and deeper than the dark triad. And a third one is power corrupting. That is, once you get people into higher positions in a hierarchy, there is a tendency for them to become less compassionate, less empathetic, more likely to cheat, both in games and on their spouses. And in general, they tend to undervalue the work of others in comparison to their own. They tend to become less risk adverse. There's a whole bunch of different characteristics which tend to be amplified. And once again, not everyone. Some people seem to be more prone to being corrupted by power than others. And the last but not least one I speak about is what I call the authoritarian impulse. And I think this one's on better empirical ground than, say, for instance, the power corrupting literature. It's the idea that when we feel threatened, most people tend to become more authoritarian in their values. That's true on both the left and the right. On the right, it's particularly bad. Right-wing authoritarians, when they feel threatened, tend to become more politically mobilized and violent. But I think collectively, these darker angels of our nature help us to understand what changed once we exited the Ice Age and once we saw the emergence of what some people would call civilization and the first states.
You've said the C word now. We will have to get to it. Maybe we won't get to it today. It depends on how much longer we talk. Going back and thinking about this concept of civilization, a lot of what you said about, you know, what the Paleolithic was like, which I should say now, both that all the reading I have done as an adult suggests that your narrative of the Paleolithic is the most currently scientifically accurate one. It's also, you know, when I bring it up with my students, because they have been, you know, molded in this Hobbes Pinker world that we all live in, they're aghast. And they immediately explain to me that everything was violence and slavery until, you know, states emerged. Another topic for another day is how we fix this. Writing books like this is a good start, and making sure people read them by not putting an A in a circle with a line through it on the cover of the book. So that's true. But with that said, I'm thinking about when you say, like, people traveled a lot. There was lots of sharing and technological and social innovation. Sure. People had communities, cosmopolitan communities, where people speak lots of languages. These are all things that the current technocrats like, that the Steven Pinkers will praise. And then they will say, they will go back. Their history will be 200, 300, 400, 500 years old. And they'll say, well, it used to be that there was just this one state called Germany, and everyone spoke German in it, and it wasn't very cosmopolitan, and people didn't get to travel a lot. And now we have these cosmopolitan communities with lots of travel and technological and social exchange. It seems that people are just trapped in the recent past, and if they find 2025 to be, and I picked Germany on purpose because there was not a Germany 500 or indeed 200 years ago. Although I recently had a scholar of the German Peasants' War on the podcast, and she, as everyone does, just used the word Germany. And I mean, she's one of the most eminent historians in the world, so I let her, but I just sat there. I wanted to say, like, please stop saying Germany. Say the polity loosely governed by the Holy Roman Empire or something, like that, because it's not fucking Germany. So people don't speak German 500 years ago. They speak all of these different dialects until Luther's Hochdeutsch eventually becomes the dominant mode, and where we got to the point that almost everyone in the state of Germany, which is less than 150 years old, spoke German, and the government had the power to keep non-German speakers out. These are all recent developments. So is part of the problem just people don't know? They don't know what 12,000 years ago was like. They don't know what 1200 AD was like. They assume there was a Germany in 1200 AD, and Germany is an 1870 thing. Is this your experience, that just the past is so flattened and a product of Enlightenment thinking that people can't put this together? And if we have, one last bit of this, if we have, you know, peace and prosperity and globalization now, that means we must not have had those things in the past, because we didn't have them in 1915 or 1942, to take two recent examples.
I often joke that for most people, history is 200 or 300 years old, which I think is frequently true. We tend to think of, well, states are pretty good today. I like Denmark. Ergo, states in the past and empires in the past must have been pretty decent to live in as well. Hence the entire idea of dark ages and golden ages, for instance. And likewise, it tends to be this idea of, well, a lot of things like human height seem to have been getting better over the last 200 years. Ergo, that just must be a continuous trajectory going forward into the future. And you can't really understand history from the last 200, 300 years. It's by most means, an incredibly anomalous period. And I think you can't really make sense of what's happening in the last 200 to 300 years without understanding what happened in the Paleolithic and, of course, the Holocene thereafter. And I think this is really critical. One of the reasons I started this book was when I first started to work at the Center for the Study of Existential Risk, where we look at big global catastrophes that could unfold, was whenever people spoke about future scenarios of doom, they almost always had some kind of understanding of history informing it. So for quite a few people, there was this idea of Technology is something we don't really control. It controls humanity. Ever since the advent of fire, technology's basically pushed us. We can't really control it. It's in general pretty good, but it can be bad. Ergo, the only thing we can really do at this stage is to try to maneuver technology towards better purposes. But there's no point trying to stop the development of things like AI, for instance, or even just try to stop the development of things like nuclear weapons. You can just simply channel innovation. You can't stop it. And ultimately, there's not much point trying to focus too much on governance because technology, not governance, is the driving engine behind humanity. And of course, also the idea of why would we want to stop it? Because it is the driver of progress as well. And if you're going to allow your picture of human history to basically mold your picture of the future, at least for me, I wanted to make sure that was an accurate as possible vision of the past. And I think actually, ideally, throughout high school, you probably want to have students doing a lot of work on deep history because it just does fundamentally inform so much of how we conduct ourselves and what we think about both the present and the future. And having this 200-year skin-deep view of history is the basis for an incredibly naive picture of both today and the future.
Yeah, and going back to, you know, this idea of, you know, what students would be studying in high school. Another, to go back to this idea of anarchism, I think this is in Graeber, but, you know, there's this bumper sticker that's like everything, you know, you need to know you learned in kindergarten, which is, you know, like be kind, share, everyone should be nice. We're working together, that sort of thing. Well, you get to high school and it's like, oh, sorry, we were lying to you because you were too young to understand that life is a brutal life is a brutal struggle for competition. And then this very thin, shallow version of history is used as an explanation for this. And I guess I'm going back to this well because again I had this conversation with a group of students because I had just been reading your book and you know they just. And this also goes back to this idea that like you won't be taken seriously as an anarchist because, you know, they knew I was an anarchist and they were just like, you just are saying this because you want, you know, humans to be good and anarchism to be able to work. So you have just decided that things were different back then than from the constant slavery. And it is, you know, I mean, part of that is true, obviously, but it seems like the technocrats want their version of history to be true because it validates their success in the system and the power and prestige that they have accumulated. And so if someone like Steven Pinker, who knows about global warming, who knows about the way that slavery is still the way that most things in this world are made, it's somewhere in the supply chain, if not all the way through the supply chain, they need all of that suffering and exploitation to have been baked in to humanity. Because otherwise they cannot explain to us why we live in the best of all possible worlds. And the suggestion that prehistory, and there's a danger, I've had a lot of conversations with this, there's a danger of making prehistory the Garden of Eden. Yep. But the suggestion that prehistory was broadly better for most people than any period in the last 200 years will call into question their life and their biases. And it strikes me that they are the ones with the axe to grind. That's probably an Iron Age metaphor. No, of course, you grind stone. Of course. A good Paleolithic metaphor. So I don't know, thoughts on that?
A couple. First of all, it's worthwhile kind of adding a bit of texture to this picture of the Paleolithic to say not everything was perfect. If you had a child, there's a 1 in 2 chance they wouldn't make it to be an adult. That's hard. That's horrible. That's a tragedy. Likewise, while we didn't have as many infectious diseases, so most of the diseases we deal with today, things like obviously COVID-19, zoonotic infections, influenza, measles, chickenpox, and of course the big ones of history like smallpox, those all appear to be quite recent things, if you will, diseases of civilization that weren't around during the Paleolithic. Still, nonetheless, we didn't have things like vaccines or any kind of way to combat bacterial infection, which would have been tough. That's, once again, it's not ideal. But all things considered, I think we tend to veer between one of two extremes, right? If you talk at all positively about the Paleolithic or about nomadic egalitarian hunter-gatherers, you are a romantic savage. And if you go to the other extent and say everything's horrible, obviously become the typical savagery barbarism type trope. And there's a midway point here of just you look at the evidence and you note that there's some things that are better and some things that are worse. I like the fact that I understand what a star is, for instance. I like the fact that I have a good understanding of how disease works and how germ theory works. And I also like the fact that if I was to have a child, there's a good chance it would survive until adulthood. But at the same time, I can very easily say I like the fact that in the Paleolithic, I probably would not have had my entire life being determined by managers and people above me, that I almost certainly would have been raised with a lot more socialization, a lot more people around me. I'd probably have a much bigger social circle, even though I do pretty well right now. And I'd probably be getting a lot more of a varied diet and a lot more exercise. And I have absolutely no qualms or hesitation in saying that if I was to be either reborn today or I could alternatively be born during the Paleolithic, I would absolutely go for the Paleolithic. Because I lucked out massively in being born in Australia with attributes that are valued today. If I were to roll the statistical dice here, I'd probably be born as a peasant farmer in India or a sweatshop worker in China. And frankly, I would choose a life in the Paleolithic over that. Absolutely. And
me too. And it's important to understand that peasants also are an invention of whatever we are calling it, civilization. It's hard for people to understand. Yeah. Sorry, I mean, maybe this is a diversion, but if you say, if I were born in this current era, I could be a peasant. For one thing, obviously, peasants still exist. People don't like that word, but people don't like the word peasant because they're biased against peasants. There's nothing wrong with the word itself. It's just they think that if someone is a subsistence farmer, I suppose, is the there's something wrong with them. But peasants did not exist 300,000 years ago. Yep. Peasantry is also, insofar as the last 5,000 or 2,000 or 12,000 years, whichever one you want to pick, is its own era, and something before 5,000 or 12,000 years ago is a different era. Being a peasant is a product of our era. Dare I call it modernity? You know, we keep pushing modernity back. Modernity used to be the 19th century, and now it's gone back to the 16th and 15th century. But the modern world, also meaning what is called civilization, created peasantry. So if people are imagining, oh, in the past I would have been a peasant, that just means they haven't gone far enough back in the past, which I keep bringing up in this interview, apparently.
Yeah, agreed. One thing that really surprised me, if not stunned me, was if you look at average male height today, it's, I think, approximately 176 centimeters on a global average. And if you look at the few skeletons we have of men from Europe during the Paleolithic, they're taller. I think they're closer to like 178. There's no reason to think that men in Europe were particularly exceptional during that time, and the few skeletons in Africa are roughly the same as well. And that's health. I mean, height and skeletal height is a pretty good general biophysical indicator of overall health. If you're taller, it tends to mean you're getting more than enough calories. You're having a pretty varied diet full of protein, and you're not experiencing things like famine or disease too much. It's very shocking, actually, that on a global average, we're still shorter today compared to our Paleolithic ancestors. Women, interestingly, seem to be shorter back in the Paleolithic, but there's a bit of a quirk there where women, when they're often in healthier conditions, they have earlier what's called menarche, which is basically the onset of puberty, which means it kind of stunts their growth, but they're actually healthier overall, which is also what you see in the wake of the Black Death as well. As men seem to get taller, women get shorter. That's probably due to the onset of menarche. Anyway, the second interesting thing here is that while we can't go back and interview a nomadic egalitarian from the Paleolithic and ask them how happy they were, we can do studies with the closest analogs. And obviously, caveat of people like the Khoisan, the Hadza, or Central African Republic hunter-gatherers, they are not perfect relics from the Ice Age. They have interacted with states, etc. Nonetheless, their lifestyles seem to be pretty similar in terms of what we see throughout the Paleolithic. Their material culture has not changed a dramatic amount, and we definitely don't see any lasting signs of inequality or domination, etc. So in short, particularly when they were first contacted, that's probably the best insight we have to what it was like to be living in the Paleolithic. And when you do happiness studies between nomadic egalitarian hunter-gatherers and compare them to people in industrialized countries, including countries like the US and Spain, you find they're happier. That whether you do what's called a life experiential or life satisfaction survey, they tend to be happier than their counterparts in the US and Spain. And if you just look at the ethnographic literature, there's lots of stories of, you know, pretty surprised ethnographers finding hunter-gatherers who are just like constantly bursting into song and dance, etc. They have lots of social connections. Once again, all the caveats of there's still lots of hardship, particularly nowadays. They're an incredibly oppressed and marginalized set of groups. But overall, their lives aren't particularly bad. And particularly compared to the most vulnerable and repressed people in industrialized countries, they're doing very well. And all this begs the question, of course, if on average we are less happy, so we're sadder and smaller than our ancestors from the Paleolithic, what happened? And this brings us, of course, to civilization.
Okay, yeah. Let me briefly say, and then we can check in on where we want to go with civilization. A formulation that I came up with, I think I've said it on the podcast, but it was in conversation with my mentor, John McGowan, which is essentially, you know, Marxist communism, this sort of like industrial proletarianism, although, you know, people like Kohei Saito, his work is so interesting, have argued that Marx sort of changed his mind about that later in life. I need to do an episode on him. Unfortunately, Kohei Saito does not do podcast interviews, so you won't be hearing me in conversation with him, sadly. But Marx wants modernity, industrial civilization, with the bad parts removed. And what William Morris wants is medieval, or, I mean, Morris focused on the Middle Ages, but it would work just as well for hunter-gatherer civilization. He wants that with the bad parts removed. And so when people say something like, oh, well, you know, why would you want to live in hunter-gatherer civilization? Everyone who has diabetes would die and we need insulin. It's like, I'm not arguing that it's not good that we are able to treat diabetes now. Many cases of diabetes are caused by industrialization, but many are not. And those people need insulin or another treatment. What I'm arguing is, if we're going to get to the world we want, and I understand this is a contentious position, the better way is to go to make our lives look more like what they used to, while retaining the good things, which mostly means healthcare. And I'm a big fan of trains, not so much of cars, as opposed to the Marxist theory, which I just think is wrong, that we can have an industrial factory proletarian based society without the exploitation that has been the feature of civilization. That just strikes me. One of those is more plausible. And then finally, given a choice between the two, I'll take straight up, as you will, the hunter-gatherer civilization with all of the deaths of infants, because at least you know your child is not going to become enslaved in a sweatshop. I would rather my child die in infancy than work in almost any mine in the history of the world.
Yeah, I think that's very valid. And I couldn't have put a bit of myself. And I found it frustrating that we often can't just seem to say trains, renewable energy, vaccines, sanitation are good. Let's have those things without nuclear weapons, SUVs, private jet planes, and 81 billionaires having more wealth than half of humanity. That shouldn't be a difficult position to hold. And when you actually, once again, similar to anarchism, when you abstract away the things that we like about hunter-gatherer culture, having more leisure time, having lots of social connections, having cultures that value play and dancing and singing, etc., having a life which is not marked by continuous domination by others, most of us would say those are good things we should strive for. But once again, as soon as you add in the lens of these what nomadic egalitarians often do, you end up with the very easy slur of the romantic savage, etc. And again, this is, I think, much of what we discussed here, including this vision of the romantic savage, if you will, anarchism, and even the term civilization, they're all just indications that we are at the pointy end of a 5,000-year propaganda campaign that has been incredibly successful. And that's also why your students have a very different view of what empirically we know about the Paleolithic and about humans.
Yeah, and this is a good place. I mean, we've been recording, I would guess, for about 50 minutes, maybe a little more. So let's talk about civilization, and then let's take stock of where we are. Maybe that'll be a good ending point. I mean, civilization is tricky in your book, as is savagery, which has both the more English language connotation of barbaric. I know that's also a contested term, but meaning filled with bloodlust and murder and rage, savagery. And then, of course, you know, when you teach people that savage or sauvage is the French word for wild in terms of wild flower. Flowers are not that savage in that sense. They are merely not touched by human hands in the Thomas Huxley sense. So savage means both this romantic thing and bloodlust monster who we must keep back deep in prehistory. In the same way, civilization is good. We all want to be civilized. That means we're good people who live in a virtuous community, probably Latin, I'm guessing. It would be, because polite would be the Greek, and civitas, that's probably Latin. And then, of course, Ramses the Great, as you and I have spoken about before, is one of the great heroes of civilization. The Qin Emperor is another hero of civilization. The British Empire was the people, they were the people talking about civilization most in the 19th and early 20th century, well, besides maybe the fucking Germans. And so civilization seems to mean murder, exploitation. You might even call it savagery. So civilization is savagery, and savagery is civilization. And I think that's the propaganda campaign you're talking about.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. When I first started to write this book, the term civilization was one I had to automatically grapple with, because when people talk about collapse, the automatic question is, what collapses? And the usual answer is civilization. And begs the question, what is civilization? And there's two problems here. One is that it's always been incredibly ambiguous. No one provides a good answer. You have the Australian archaeologist Gordon Shield, who is interestingly a Marxist, but still tried to define civilization in terms of this checklist of different attributes, things like long-distance trade, which, by the way, all hunter-gatherers had, writing, which you have empires like the Inca didn't have. They had the quipu instead, a kind of accounting mechanism, and the presence of cities. And urbanism varies dramatically across different societies. In short, you never can quite come up with a checklist which really ticks all the boxes across all the case studies. And even then, it's not really a good kind of causal definition or explanation as to what's happening here. And the second problem is, as you've already alluded to, that civilization has particular connotations. So it originally comes from, as you mentioned, the Latin root civilitas, which is actually, the definition is more about city living, but it has all these connotations of being polite, restraint, moderation, good political conduct. That's all the things we, of course, associate with civilized behavior today. Yet, empirically, when you look at what happens during the first states, whether it's the First Dynasty of Egypt, the Xia Dynasty in China, or Uruk in Mesopotamia, they tend to be marked by things like warfare preceding it, patriarchy, slavery, and often mass human sacrifice. When we talk about civilization, I think the reason we struggle to come up with a good definition is because it's really uncomfortable to look it in the eye and to acknowledge what exactly is common across Cahokia, Uruk, and the modern day United States. And that is simply societies which are based upon domination, in which one person rules over others through the use of violence. And that's something that you need to do mass scale human sacrifice. It's something you need to build really big pyramids just to celebrate one person going to the afterlife. And frankly, it's something you need in order to do, in order to have things like nuclear weapons. It's very uncomfortable to acknowledge that civilization, that's the key thing here, in particular because it ends up being what I call in the book evolutionary backsliding. That if what got us through the Ice Age and what makes us very unique as humans is our mobile, interconnected, egalitarian nature, then suddenly once we start to develop into dominance hierarchies, we start to look a lot more like the harems of gorillas in the hierarchies of chimpanzees. It's both kind of less appealing, but also a bit less special as well. And yet that is, I believe, the most accurate way to depict what happens roughly 5,000 years ago. And it's worthwhile asking the question, why does that happen? What's different in these areas that develop what I call Goliaths rather than civilizations? And the term Goliath is quite intentionally chosen. It's because most of these things, at least in the Near East, develop in the Bronze Age. They also are surprisingly fragile, and they're built upon violence and tend to grow into a great stature. So they're very similar to the biblical idea of Goliath, this massive warrior who once again was from the Bronze Age and who is surprisingly fragile because all it takes is one stone slung between his eyes to kill him. And I also like Goliath because it doesn't make things seem too ethereal. You know, Lewis Mumford has this idea of the mega machine. I've heard other terms like the super organism, for instance. It all makes it seem very almost godlike and abstract. And at the end of the day, sure, these are often bigger structures, but ultimately they're made up of people. And people can undo them as well. And so I like Goliath because it's both an individual person and, of course, a larger scale structure too. And when you actually start to look at why do Goliaths arise and where do they arise, it starts to give you a very good insight into how they arose in the first place. At this stage, many listeners may be wondering, isn't this at odds with what Wengo and Graeber say in The Dawn of Everything, that we've always had dominance hierarchies, we've always had inequality, and what we really lost a couple of thousand years ago was actually the ability to switch between different forms of social organization? And while I'm a huge fan of David Graeber, who's one of my original intellectual inspirations, I think they're just simply wrong on this one. One problem is that they essentially have to ignore all the evidence that we have from the Paleolithic, and they have to ignore all the evidence we have from evolutionary biology in order to make this feasible. In short, for 300,000 years roughly, we have no enduring signs of inequality or dominance-based societies. All the finds they point to as being potential signs of inequality are from one very unique period, which is the Upper Paleolithic in Europe. And even then, there's only a couple of finds. So things like houses built from mammoth bones in modern-day Russia, and several burials across different parts of Europe that seem to have individuals buried with goods from far away and more a kind of luxury items. The problem is those aren't accompanied by any signs of actually having an enduring hierarchy. And even as Wengo and Graeber note, they're often of individuals who are things like children or deformed individuals, not exactly signs of one alpha male taking over. The other thing they point towards is that we have hunter-gatherer groups today, which often flip between more autocratic and more democratic forms of social organization. So the Inuit during summer tend to be in smaller family groups where the male, the father has a lot more dominance over the family unit. And then in winter, they come together into larger groups, which often practice things like partner sharing and tend to have more collective governance. And there's a whole bunch of other examples they go through. There's a few problems with this. One is that Paleolithic Africa has very different seasonal patterns. Seasonal change would have been likely very muted. Bear in mind, it's during an ice age as well. And again, we just have no signs of this actually happening throughout history. And the second is that, I hate to say, they often seem to do some errors in terms of their analysis here. So for instance, they point towards the Nambaquari people as having a flip towards autocratic arrangements during certain seasons. This is based upon outdated literature, which has basically been updated to suggest they don't really do that. And even in the case of the Inuit, they make the argument that this is all based upon agency, people making choices, but the actual source they cite here says that it's mainly due to environmental circumstance. But in short, we don't have any strong evidence that we lived in dominance hierarchies or we had large-scale persisting inequalities. There's no archaeological evidence for this. And importantly, once again, when we look at all the other forms of evidence, like biological anthropology, it doesn't suggest that's the case. Instead, the only time you actually start to see persistent, enduring inequality, and you start to see across generations example of rulers, is once you enter the Holocene, once the world warms and we get access to certain resources, in particular, grain.
Yes, grain, the Goliath fuel and the great subject of James C. Scott.
The other problem here with Wenger and Graeber is that if you accept the premise that we've always had inequality and dominance hierarchies and all this is based upon social change, it becomes very difficult to justify how we got stuck, how we ended up with these Goliaths. And there's actually just very easy, good material explanations for this. When you look across the world, there are five sites where you have original Goliaths arise. We have the original states of the world, the Xia Dynasty in the Yellow River Valley of China, Montalban in Mesoamerica, Tiwanaku, or potentially the Wari in South America. In the Near East, we have the city of Uruk, and in Egypt, we have the First Dynasty of Egypt, which may be the earliest of all of them. In all those cases, they only arise in areas where you have agriculture. It's not just sheer agriculture or having a surplus, because we have other areas in the world which have agriculture and don't develop states. Papua New Guinea has agriculture roughly the same time as Egypt, roughly 5,000 BCE, never develops either pyramids or has pharaonic leaders. The key difference here is they're growing taro, yam, and bananas, and Egypt is growing wheat. The big difference there is wheat can be seen, stolen, and stored. Wheat is something which is very hard to miss. It basically tells you when it's ready to harvest. It has very tall stalks. It has one particular harvest period. It can be stored for decades potentially. And that makes it very easily as a tax crop. It's very easy to appropriate or to loot. By comparison, things like tubers, like sweet potato or taro, tend to only last 6 months once they're harvested. And they don't have one easy harvest period. They can often be left in the ground for a long period of time, which means they're a very bad tax crop. They're very hard for an elite class to basically take. On top of that, across most of these areas, they tend to have a very certain geography. They often have very few exit options. So, for instance, Mesopotamia is called the land between two rivers in Greek. That's what Mesopotamia means. And Egypt is stuck between the Nile and the Red Sea. And on top of all that, states tend to arise after you have certain weapons being developed. Both the First Dynasty of Egypt and Uruk arise after the introduction of Bronze Age weapons, in particular bronze-held swords and axes. And that all points towards a very particular picture. So monopolizable weapons, caged land, and lootable resources, what I call Goliath fuel, that can perfectly explain why states arise in certain parts of the world and not others. And it paints a very clear picture of what actually happens while we go from being egalitarians and nomadic into being Goliaths. And that's essentially that you have one small group gaining the ability to take critical resources from others and hold them by using superior weaponry, and then craft stories to justify it all. And that's the big thing that actually changes there. So history is not a story of progress. It's not a story of golden ages. It's a story of organized crime.
Okay. I could not agree more. I know I sent you that little blog post I wrote, history has a tyrannical bias. It's so true. And once you see it, you know, I know we have to end, but Egypt is opening a new museum, a new giant national museum. And I just read a review of it, and it was like, finally, this, you know, this beautiful civilization gets to tell its own story. And it's like, well, first of all, the people who live in Egypt right now do not really have a strong cultural connection to those dynasties, either, I mean, certainly not like genetically, but even culturally. And secondly, it, you know, like, I really hope that we're not reading 2000 years from now, finally, you know, the Third Reich's museum is being built in Berlin, and the Third Reich is a beautiful civilization that is getting remembered as it should be. That's what you're doing when you valorize the pharaohs. You're valorizing the monsters. Leaving that aside, this is where we're going to have to stop. We don't have to end this conversation in the broader picture. We mostly talked about the first part of the book, not exclusively, but maybe we can do two more of these, although it'll be a little while. Couple of last things. I do want to say that you mentioned, you know, not being a dick, which is a great anarchist idea. I was just reading recently, someone was attacking Orwell because he said, really, it just comes down to being decent. And this person was like, no, that's silly. You need all sorts of institutions and rules. And maybe you do, but it starts with not being a dick. And I appreciate you. I appreciate you saying that. Finally, I want to real quick throw out, just in case someone is able to grab this off the transcript, just like the Daily Mail or just Wall Street Journal, if anyone wants to write a hit piece on you, I think we can give them the quote, writing this book made me an anarchist, Luke Kemp. I think actually I said, did writing this book make you an anarchist? And you said, yes, but in the transcript, it'll get muddled up. So writing this book made me an anarchist, Luke Kemp.
It'll definitely get a lot of views.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I can't wait. For the New York Post to run that story. And, you know, this has been an interview with the closeted anarchist intellectual Luke Kemp. Anything else you would like to say, Luke, before we go?
No, simply that I very much look forward to speaking to you again, Graham. The only reason I actually, you know, write these books is so I get more opportunities to talk to you. So.
Well, then you were very clever about coming on the podcast twice before you finished the book. This has been truly a long-term plan.
Four-dimensional chess, my friend. Four-dimensional chess.
Yeah, all right. Did you really have to end on this moment of Australian sarcasm? You couldn't have said something genuine to me.
Okay, let me see something genuine.
Jesus, you don't have anything genuine to say? It's getting worse and worse.
I don't know. I felt like I used up my really good line with the organized crime bit, and now I'm lost. Jeez.
All right. Well, we've left Luke Kemp speechless. Luke, thanks. Look, it really is so much fun. Oh shit! Now you have something. And as I am saying goodbye. All right. What you got?
One way of phrasing this, rather than this book turned me into an anarchist, just as truthfully, and I think probably much better in the public eye, I would simply say this book made me, in many ways, yes, more pessimistic about the future, but far more optimistic, but also more realistic about humanity.
People are generally as decent as the systems they are in allow them to be. I think that's true, and I think this book is a good argument for that.
Excellent. That's a great compliment. Thank you, Graham.
All right. Thanks so much, Luke. Bye now.
My pleasure. Bye.